Chapter 38. Caroline. 1957 to 1958. Mother and I traveled half the globe once we finally left Paris after the war. India and Italy. A cruise up the British coast to Scotland. The first thing I did when Mother and I landed back in New York for good was help organize that year's April in Paris ball. It was an elaborate fundraiser that supported any number of charities, French and American, including my new Ravensbrook Rabbits Committee. It had been over a decade since Anis Postel-Vinet had introduced me to the cause, and Mother and I had grown terribly attached, corresponding regularly with the Polish women. Wallace Simpson, formerly known as the Duchess of Windsor, the American divorcee who'd married England's former King Edward VIII, would be attending the ball, and I planned to ask for her support. The Waldorf Ballroom had never looked better. The cavalcade of Hollywood glitterati and Washington VIPs went through endless rounds of how-do-you-dos, highballs in hand. But one woman was stealing the show. Man or woman, it made no difference. All eyes were on Marilyn Monroe. Betty and I were worker bees on a committee that turned the ballroom into a Manhattan matron's idea of a French wonderland. A massive dance floor anchored the center of the room, flanked by long dining tables. We festooned tricolor bunting above the stage and helped drag an enormous golden statue of General Lafayette on horseback center stage, where he reared up out of a sea of white lilies. The decorating committee was well-funded, for this was a group with assets to spare. Men wore tuxedos and ladies wore red, white, or blue. Marilyn Monroe wore a midnight blue sequin gown that did a marvelous job of showing off her own assets. I felt like a screen siren myself that night, dressed in a hydrangea blue chaparelli with a flirty little train that dusted the floor as I walked along the tables, performing the last of my decorative duties. I thought I looked pretty good for being on the other side of 50. I set a red rose, dethorned, in a plastic water vial at every female guest's plate, reading place cards as I went. A who's who of A-list Hollywood stars and political bigwigs. Senator John Kennedy, Jacqueline Kennedy, Mr. Winston Guest, C.Z. Guest, Raymond Bulger, Gwendolyn Bulger, Mr. Paul Rodier. A cold splash washed over me. Paul? How could I have not known? It had been 10 years since I'd seen him. Next to him, Lena Rodier. He was remarried. Delightful. What had happened to Rena? I set a rose next to Lena's place and finished quickly, wanting to distance myself from Paul. I'd seen his name in the news here and there in connection with new acting projects, but I'd never seen his films. What could I possibly say to him? Actor Jean Marais and actress Françoise Arnaud, dressed in French military uniform, started off the evening by entering the ballroom in an open carriage drawn by two black horses. As I watched, Betty, radiant in blue organza, found me and handed me a glass of champagne. "You should see the gift bags this year, Caroline. All Dior, and good caviar, finally." The gift bags at the ball were actually suitcases packed so tight with luxury goods, guests needed porters to carry them to waiting cars. "Can you believe all the movie people? You would have been big in pictures if you'd stuck with acting. Right there with Gloria Swanson. Well, you're ready for your close-up tonight. You look fabulous, honestly. Wish I could say the same for poor Wallace Simpson. She's positively fossilized. Saw her in the powder room, and she complimented my dress. 'Is that Wallace blue?' she said. 'Really, it's always about her.' 'It's good she came. It was no hardship, Caroline. She lives upstairs in the towers. The staff has to call her Your Royal Highness, even though she's not officially allowed to use that title. And the Duke is here. Looking a bit dazed, I think Wallace has him medicated. At least it's good press for the cause. Really? Try and get the reporters away from Marilyn and Arthur. I'm going to ask Wallace to support the Polish ladies. Good luck, Caroline. She's tight as a tick. She and the Duke do nothing but charity work, as long as there are cameras around. Speaking of cameras, I was going to let you find out on your own, but Paul Rodier is here. I drank half the flute of champagne in one gulp, the bubbles like fizzy fireworks going down. How do you know? I saw him with his new wife, some child actress. He looks good, tan as a Palm Beach matron. They must both be wearing girdles. Betty waited for my reaction with a sidelong look. Don't go running off now. It's fine, I said, my stomach doing somersaults. I actually saw their place cards. I have nothing to say to him. Well, if you two do speak, stay away from the knives. Don't be ridiculous, I said, draining the glass. It had been years since I'd seen the man, and I was hardly carrying a torch. Betty went to find her husband, whom she'd spotted winding his way through the crowd with two champagne flutes, and I went in search of Wallace Simpson. Though reviews on her were mixed, she seemed like a compassionate woman. I hoped she'd be sympathetic to the plight of the Polish ladies and lend her support. I squeezed through the crush of guests, the train of my gown trod upon by more than one patent leather dress shoe. I found Wallace off to the side of the ballroom with Rosemary Warburton Gaynor, wife of a prominent plastic surgeon, Dr. William C.T. Gaynor, the chair of the ball. Up close, it was plain to see why Wallace had been 15 times on the international best dressed list. She stood in a pillar of white Montbochet lace, her dark hair clenched in a tight chignon. Her husband waited nearby, half listening to the British ambassador, eyes trained on Wallace like an aged sporting dog ready for his master's whistle. Wallace and Rosemary stood together, gazelles at a watering hole, a stone's throw away from where Marilyn Monroe sat with her husband, Arthur Miller. I lingered nearby, waited for Rosemary to notice me, and accepted another glass of champagne to help bolster my courage. It isn't every day one asks the Duchess of Windsor for money. Before long, lovely Rosemary noticed me and reached out, seeming happy for the diversion. "Oh, Caroline! Come meet the Duchess!" Dressed in a floor-length off-the-shoulder white gown with a ruffled hem, Rosemary drew me closer. "Your Grace, may I introduce my friend, Caroline Faraday? Caroline Faraday, may I present Her Grace, the Duchess of Windsor?" Wallace hesitated and then extended one satin-gloved hand. I shook her hand, wondering what one calls a divorcee married to an abdicated king. I went with Rosemary's lead and chose Your Grace. So much had been written about Wallace Simpson at that time, I felt I already knew her. The press obsessed over every aspect of her life. Her French couture, her large hands, the mole on her chin, her dismissive attitude, and above all, her jewelry. Rosemary waved in the direction of the dance floor. "Caroline has been awfully busy helping us put all this together." "So nice to meet you," Wallace said. My heart beat faster. How to bring up the rabbits? Why was I so nervous? I'd once played to an audience of Fez Shriners in Boston who'd passed a gin bottle down the front row of the theater. That was much scarier than this. "Can you believe Marilyn Monroe?" said Wallace to no one in particular. She looked toward the horde of people clustered about Marilyn and her husband. A French television news crew, lights bright, was interviewing Marilyn and Arthur at their table. "Every photographer here is smitten with her." "It's the dress," Rosemary said. "Not one's even glanced my way," Wallace said. Mrs. Gaynor turned to me. "Caroline works tirelessly for the downtrodden, Your Grace. She has quite a reputation." "How is that?" Wallace asked, perking up as she accepted a glass of champagne from a tuxedoed waiter, perhaps hoping for scandal. "How nice it is, when one's own reputation is damaged, to hear of others' misfortunes." "A good reputation, of course," Rosemary said. "She heads up an American arm of a French organization to assist women in need. She's been awarded both the Cross of Liberation and the French Legion of Honor for her work." "Don't go near those canapés, dear. Too salty," Wallace called to the Duke, who stood nearby, apparently mesmerized by a waiter's tray of livermousse canapés. "Yes, I head up American Friends of the ADIR, Your Grace," I said. "We support women who have returned from concentration camps, help them regain normal lives." "Still?" said Wallace, drifting back into the conversation. "It's been how many years since the war? Doesn't their government help?" "Some, but they still need assistance. We're working to get reparations for a group of women from Ravensbrück, a German concentration camp near Fürstenberg." "The Duke and I try our best to avoid any place with Berg in the name." Since the couple's pre-war trip to Berlin, where they were received by Hitler, the press often revisited the faux pas, even 20 years after the fact. "The women are called the Ravensbrück Rabbits, Your Grace," I said. "Polish women, girls really at the time, experimented upon by doctors there." "Just terrible," Rosemary said. "Poles," said Wallace, a furrow between her brows. "I thought you worked for the French. It's all terribly confusing." Wallace's attention shifted to a fashion show model who settled near us, one hand on her hip, the other held high, a diamond cuff on the wrist. The Duke raised his eyebrows at Wallace as if asking her opinion of the bracelet. Wallace sent him a noncommittal shrug. "We help women of any nationality who've returned from the camps," I said. "Conditions are especially difficult in Poland. Many of them are sick, some dying, and still have no reparations since West Germany doesn't recognize communist Poland as a country." Wallace glanced about the room, perhaps looking for the exit. "I'm not in a position to donate to anything these days. We have to bow and scrape for everything we're given. We're not even on the civil list, if you can imagine. Plus, the world has grown weary of all that death and destruction. Those stories even bore the people who went through it all. Who hasn't written a memoir?" Wallace turned to the Duke, smoothed the royal Peter Pan's hair in place, and fussed with the gold medals and ribbons at his chest. She removed a canapé from his hand, placed it back on the silver tray he'd taken it from, and took the Duke by the hand. "Let's pop up and check on the dogs." She motioned for the waiter with the silver tray to follow. "Pugs need to eat at least every 2 hours," she said with a smile, and swept off toward the exit. "If you'll excuse me, Rosemary," I said. Apparently, Wallace was not sympathetic to my cause after all. "Good luck with your fundraising, dear," Rosemary said as I turned to leave. "I'll certainly be donating. And maybe pop in on Norman Cousins at the Saturday Review. He and his darling wife helped the Hiroshima Maidens, after all." "I will, Rosemary. Thank you." I trekked the periphery of the ballroom in search of more champagne, smarting from Wallace's rebuff. I was careful to play the "if I were Paul Rodier, where would I be" game in order to avoid him. He would plant himself as far from the whole fashion show spectacle as possible, probably near the food, definitely near the bar. I circumvented the bar and walked by the Dior models as they twirled and sashayed through the guests. A waiter passed through the crowd, offering microscopic potatoes topped with sour cream and caviar. Was all the food that night to be tiny? I stepped toward the tray but stopped short, my train pinned. "Would you mind?" I said, turning. "Paul." And by his side stood a ravishing creature. Lena, no doubt.
"Nietzsche said that a diet predominantly of potatoes leads to the use of liquor,"
Paul said, shoe still on my train. His voice robbed me of my powers of speech. It didn't help that his lady love was almost too beautiful to look at, her eyes thick-lashed, with the kind of perfect face a cigarette lends just the right amount of cruelty to. She was tall, impossibly young, and leggy.
"I see you're stalking me,"
Paul said. The girl wandered off to the fashion show, sipping champagne, apparently not threatened if she'd registered me at all. "You can remove your foot," I said.
"You have a habit of disappearing,"
Paul said. "Only when provoked." He left his foot there. I had expected Paul to have recovered since the time I saw him last, but was not prepared for how good he looked, fit and oddly well-tanned for April. "Do I need to take off my dress?" Paul smiled.
"This party is finally getting good."
"Really, Paul? It's Schiaparelli." He released my train.
"I have the exits covered."
"Don't concern yourself."
"Champagne?"
asked a passing waiter, flutes bubbling on his silver tray. "No, thank you," I said with massive restraint. "I need to be going."
"I thought about calling you last night," Paul said. "Figured your mother would talk to me at least."
"After all these years?" "It doesn't matter."
"But I got into some cognac. You know how that is?"
"Not really."
"I hoped you'd be here, among your people."
I shrugged. "It's a good cause." Another waiter came by.
"Champagne?"
Paul took two flutes.
"I hoped we could talk about it all."
"That isn't necessary. It's been almost a decade, Paul."
"Have you ever read one of my letters?"
"I really need to be going."
"Aren't you the least bit curious about my side of it?"
I took a glass from him with a shaky hand. "Not really."
"Don't you owe it to me, leaving me flat?"
"If that's how you remember it," I said. I watched Paul's new wife consider a model's scarlet shift. Had she ever tasted foie gras? How did she stay so fit in a country that frowned upon vigorous exercise? A photographer came by.
"Can I get a picture, Mr. Rodier?"
"Why not?" Paul said.
He pulled me to him with more force than necessary, one arm around my waist. He still wore sumare. Did his new wife like it? Impossible not to.
"Smile, Caroline. Pretend you like me."
The flashbulb blinded us both for a second.
"Thanks, Mr. Rodier,"
the photographer said and wandered off.
"Last time we were in this room, I was in command of that stage," Paul said.
I just nodded and pretended to be recovering my eyesight from the flash, afraid speaking would unleash a few tears. "You've been tanning," I said after a moment.
"Ken, It was horrible. I hate all that.
I'm sure. So, where is Rena?
Who knows? Last seen on the Greek island of Hydra with a young man half her age.
How wonderful for her. I meant it. Rena deserved her time in the sun.
You may have kicked me to the curb, but life did go on, Caroline. I guess I don't make the best decisions when it comes to women.
Maybe give them up for Lent.
Paul smiled.
It's good to see you again, see? You hungry? I'm taking Lena to meet some film people. I know a little place by the Hudson.
Look, Paul, I obviously never really knew you. Let's just leave it at that. Maybe remember the good things.
I turned.
I have to go.
Paul caught my wrist.
Nothing has ever been as good as our time in New York. You ruined me for love, you know.
Looks like it, I said, watching his Lena pluck a lobster canapé from a tray.
What's wrong with you? I've been through hell. You're not the only person affected here.
Mon cher, Lena called to Paul. I'm famished. I really was invisible to her as she waved Paul to follow.
Come here, darling, Paul called to her.
Lena worked her way toward us.
It had been a long night. Did I have to meet his wife? Oh, please, Paul, I'd rather not.
Paul pulled his Lena to him, one arm around her waist.
Lena, I'd like you to meet...
Caroline Faraday, Lena said. How did I not recognize you?
The girl took my hand and pulled me to her.
Of course I know you from photographs, with Ellen Hayes. What was it like to be on the same stage with her?
Thank you, but I really must be going.
She runs away, Lena, Paul said. You need to hold on to her.
Lena held my arm with her other hand.
Oh, please. I'll do anything to have lunch. In Paris. The next time you're there.
I'd rather not.
But, Father, you must convince her.
A chill ran down my arms. Father?
Miss Caroline Faraday, Lena Rodière, Paul said,
his smile still more dangerous than ever at close range.
Pascaline is my stage name, but do call me Lena. How had I not seen? I too played Balthazar, Miss Faraday. My first role, just like you. Father's told me everything about you. Do call me Caroline, dear, I said as I stared at her. Lena was a perfect mix of her parents. Tall, with her father's stage presence, no doubt.
You must have been a perfect Balthazar, Lena. The girl circled me in her arms and held me tight to her. The lovely child I'd found at Orphelinat Saint-Philippe. Pascaline, born on Easter. Pascaline released me.
Do say you'll come to Paris, Caroline, and to have my first lead role. It would mean the world to have you there.
I nodded. It was all I could do to contain the tears. She was a darling girl with her father's charm.
Of course, dear, I said.
Well, we must be going, Paul said.
Father's introducing me to movie people, Lena said.
Au revoir, Caroline.
Paul kissed me on each cheek, the familiar scratch of his beard. My hair shirt.
How about you write me back this time? At some point, even I give up.
You haven't changed, I said.
He smiled.
I guess somewhere in a corner of our hearts, we are always 20.
Paul disappeared into the crowd, and I felt the old rip of him leaving. But this time, it was a little easier, somehow.
Had that just happened? Paul's daughter had invited me to Paris?
I escaped into a cab after a bellboy heaved my gift bag into the trunk, its contents already earmarked for charity. As the cab drove off, I caught a glimpse of Paul in the crowd and felt a rush of retrouvailles, another one of those words that do not translate into English, which means the happiness of meeting someone you love again after a long time. I hugged myself there in the back of the cab, fine with going home alone. Would he write? Maybe. I might even write back if I had time. The following day, I took Rosemary Gaynor's advice and called Norman Cousins, famed editor of the Saturday Review, hoping to chat with him for a moment in his office. Perhaps have him mention the Polish women in his magazine. He suggested I come by that afternoon. I sat in the reception area, paging through the newspaper. I turned to the society page by habit and saw a full page of photos of the April in Paris ball. Just under, a picture of Marilyn Monroe and the British ambassador, his gaze fixed upon her décolletage, was a photo of Paul and me. I just about fell off my lobby chair. Though his tuxedo was cut in the European style, a bit too nipped at the waist, and my train was soiled, we did make a reasonably handsome couple. The caption read, "Miss Faraday and Paul Rodier, back on Broadway?" I was still reeling from seeing the photo when the receptionist ushered me down a hallway past oversized prints of Saturday Review covers in aluminum frames to a conference room. Norman had gathered his staff at the long conference table, a yellow legal pad at each place.
"Nice to meet you, Caroline," Norman said, as he stood to greet me. It was impossible not to be charmed by his old-fashioned good looks and generous smile, though even the simplest bow tie can be most unbecoming on the wrong man. Norman wore his Madras butterfly with aplomb.
"You have our undivided attention for a whole 5 minutes."
Norman went to the far end of the room and leaned against the wall. I was thrown for a moment to be in the presence of such a distinguished editor, known around the world. All at once, the butterflies in my stomach would not settle, and my mouth went dry. I summoned Helen Hayes's advice, which had always helped me on stage.
"Don't be boring. Use your whole body."
I drew myself up and started strong.
"Mr. Cousins, since you and your wife have raised a considerable amount of money for the Hiroshima Maidens..." I paused and looked about the room. Norman's staff was anything but attentive. They fidgeted with their watches and pens and wrote on their pads. How could a person communicate with such a distracted audience?
"I thought you might be equally interested in this group of women in similar circumstances."
"These are Polish women?"
Norman asked, playing with his handheld tape recorder.
"I'm afraid I can't continue without your full attention, Mr. Cousins. I need to use the little time we have effectively, you see."
Norman and his staff leaned forward, all eyes on me. I had my audience.
"Yes. Polish women, Catholics, political prisoners arrested for their work with the Polish underground. Held as prisoners at Ravensbrück concentration camp. Hitler's only major concentration camp for women, and used for medical experimentation. There was a special doctor's trial at Nuremberg, but the world has forgotten the victims, and there's been no help or support for the ones who survived."
Norman averted his gaze and looked out the window to the taupe stone rectangles and water towers of Gotham that filled the view 10 stories up.
"I don't know if our readers will be up for another campaign so soon, Miss Faraday."
"The Hiroshima Project isn't even off the books yet,"
said a man built like a pipe cleaner, his Dave Garraway glasses at least 2 sizes too big for his face.
I knew him by sight as Walter Strong Whitman, a man who attended our church, though we'd never been introduced. These women were operated upon in a complex series of experiments, I said. I passed a series of 8x10 glossies around the table and watched the staffers' faces as they passed each photo on to the next person, revulsion turning to horror. Norman stepped to the table.
My God, Caroline! These barely look like legs. This one is missing whole bones and muscles. How can they walk?
Not well, as you can imagine. They hopped about the camp. That, in part, is why they were called the rabbits. That and the fact that they served as the Nazis' laboratory animals.
How do they even make it home to Poland?
Norman asked. However they could. The Swedish Red Cross rescued some. Some were sent home by train when Russians liberated the camp.
What are their immediate needs?
Norman asked. I stepped closer to Norman. They are having terrible trouble in Poland, behind the Iron Curtain with little access to modern medical care and no help from the German government.
The Iron Curtain, Mr. Strong Whitman said with a laugh. We have no place messing with all that.
West Germany has compensated other deportees, but not the rabbits, since they don't recognize communist Poland as a country. Some have died from the simplest conditions we can cure here.
I don't know, Caroline, Norman said. The Russians aren't cooperating with anyone these days.
Why should these girls have to suffer because their oppressors won't allow them to leave the country?
Murphy got into East Germany for the United Airlines story,
one young staffer said.
This might work as a travel piece,
said a woman in a handsome houndstooth jacket. The Pan Am client might help, said another.
This is a terrible idea, Norman, Strong Whitman said. We can't go to our readers for every little thing, on the dole for this and that. Our readers couldn't care less about Poland.
Why don't we find out? I said.
This is a literary magazine, Miss Faraday,
Strong Whitman said.
We can't be expected to cover the pet charity story of every club woman in New York.
Club woman? I took a deep breath. You can maintain high standards and still aid the disadvantaged. Norman has proven that with the maidens.
We can run a piece in lifestyle and offer an address for donations, Norman said. Nothing too fancy, mind you. Maybe a page. This country's charitable muscle has atrophied, Strong Whitman said. It has been how many years since the war ended? 12? No one will give.
What address should we print? Asked a young woman with a steno pad. The Hay, Main Street, Bethlehem, Connecticut, I said. Were they really doing this? Every muscle relaxed.
Sure you want mail sent to your home address, Miss Faraday?
The woman asked.
How's the post office in Bethlehem?
Norman asked.
Can they handle some extra mail?
I thought of our postmaster, Earl Johnson. White as Wonder Bread in his summer pith helmet and khaki shorts, often thrown by a misspelled surname.
Why, it's first rate, I said. They are inundated with mail every year, since everyone wants the Bethlehem stamp cancellation on their Christmas cards. Our post office can handle this.
Bethlehem it is, Norman said. Congratulations, Caroline. Let's see if we can bring your rabbits to America.
Norman ended up writing a lovely article about the rabbits, 4 pages long. It began, "As I start to write, I know my greatest difficulty will be to convince people that what is told here is not a glimpse into the bowels of an imaginary hell, but part of our world." And only got better from there. Explaining in careful detail the plight of the girls and their grim situation.
After the Saturday Review went to print, a few letters trickled in, one asking if the rabbits needed a theatrical agent, another inquiring whether the ladies could perform at a 4-H club meeting. I faced the reality that America might indeed have charity fatigue. The following week, on a glorious, warm fall morning so hazy it was like looking at the world through cheesecloth, I finished feeding the horses in the barn and walked to our Bethlehem post office to pick up the mail. Our sow, whom Mother had named Lady Chatterley, followed close behind, apparently unable to let me out of her sight. I passed Mother's Litchfield Garden Club friends assembled in the garden, washing down Sergei's coconut washboard cookies with whirligig punch, their crystal cups flashing rainbows as they sipped. Sally Bloss, Mother's lieutenant, still in garden clogs, her bandana tied like a baby's bib, stood at the front of the group, lecturing on their topic of the day. Wasps, the garden's friend. Slight, dark-haired Nellie Bird Wilson stood adjacent, skinny as a wasp herself, holding a presumably vacant, papery nest aloft. Mother's social calendar was much fuller than mine, filled with garden club, charity fates at her Nutmeg Square and Round Dance Club, and coaching her baseball team. Once I made it to the post office, just a few steps across the street from the hay, the American flag above the door waved me in, and I left Lady Chatterley with nose to the screen door. Our little Bethlehem post office was a warren of small rooms tucked under the wing of Johnson Brothers Grocery. Johnson Brothers was a town meeting place, with our only gas pump and ice cream counter. I found Earl Johnson in his mailroom, a tight space no bigger than a closet. He sat atop his high stool, a white wall of mail cubbies peppered with envelopes behind him. For his clothes, Earl favored the neutral part of the color wheel, giving the impression that if he stood still long enough, he would become indistinguishable from his mail. Beads of perspiration shone on his forehead, no doubt due to that morning's 10 minutes of rigorous mail sorting. Earl leaned toward me through the window and slid a flyer for the upcoming Bethlehem Fair my way.
"Been hot,"
Earl said, unable to look me in the eye. Was I that ferocious? "It has indeed, Earl."
"Hope you're not here to see the barber downstairs. He's not working today."
I took the flyer. "Is this the only mail for me?" Earl stood and sidled out of his mail closet.
"Can you help me with something, Miss Faraday?"
"Country life has its charms, but I had a sudden yearning and appreciation for the Manhattan post office at 34th Street, that massive columned complex of efficiency." "Must we, Earl?" Earl waved me down the back hallway, and I followed. He lingered next to a closed door. "Well," I said, "open it."
"Can't,"
he said with a shrug. I fanned myself with the flyer. "Well, get the key, for heaven's sake."
"It's not locked."
I took the knob in hand and turned it, then pushed the door with one hip, but it only opened a crack into the darkened room. "Something's blocking the door, Earl. What do you do here all day? It can't take much to keep things tidy."
"Clyde!"
Earl called at the top of his voice. Mr. Gardner's nephew came running.
"Yes, Earl,"
said dear Clyde, who was no thicker than 2 sheets of paper.
"Get in there for Miss Faraday,"
Earl said.
"Yes, sir,"
said Clyde, happy to have a mission that celebrated his size. Clyde slid through the door opening like a stink bug slipping under a window sash. I put my lips to the door crack.
"Open the door, Clyde."
"Can't, Miss Faraday. There's stuff in front of it."
"Stuff? Where was Clyde getting his slang? You really need to clean this place up, Earl."
Earl towed a knot of wood in the floor.
"Just clear the door, Clyde," I said. "Open the window shades, then we can help."
I heard shuffling, a groan from Clyde, and the snap of an ascendant window shade.
"Almost there, Miss Faraday," Clyde said.
Clyde opened the door, and a lovely Steinway smile seized his face, his teeth white and straight as keys. The room was heaped with canvas bags, each big enough to fit Clyde himself, U.S. Mail stamped in blue letters on all of them. The bags covered the floor and the counter that ran around the room. Some had burst at their rope handles, belching out piles of letters and packages. I waded in through an avalanche of envelopes.
"It's all addressed to some rabbits, Miss Faraday," Clyde said. "Look, one from Hawaii."
"My God, Earl," I said, a bit dizzy. "All for us?"
"Got 10 more in the truck. Been dumping them in here through the windows."
"Whatever happened to neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds, Earl?"
"Beg pardon, miss?"
"Why didn't you tell me?" I scooped up a handful of letters with return addresses from Boston, Las Vegas, Mexico.
"At Christmas, I have 15 extra employees," Earl said. "It's just me here, Summers. There's more in the basement. So much the barber can't get in there."
Mr. Gardner led Mother's Garden Club over with a convoy of wheelbarrows, and we ferried the mail back to the hay, with Clyde astride one bag riding it like a pony, Lady Chatterley struggling to keep up. We opened every letter, separating them into piles on the dining room table, and called out their contents.
17 Magazine is designing a clothing line for the girls," Sally Bloss said. "Dr. Jacob Fine at Beth Israel Hospital donating medical care."
Nellie Bird Wilson waved a piece of Roy Rogers stationery.
"Kevin Clawson from Baton Rouge sent his allowance."
"How lovely," I said, scribbling it all down. Mother couldn't rip open envelopes fast enough.
"National Jewish Hospital in Denver, Caroline."
"Wayne State University," Mr. Gardner said. "Dr. Jerome Krause, dentist."
Sally held up a letter on blue-castled letterhead.
"Disneyland in Anaheim is donating passes. The girls are to be Mr. Disney's honored guests." "The Danforth Foundation is forwarding a check, Caroline," Mother said. "A whopper."
Nellie fanned herself with an envelope as she read, "The Converse Rubber Company wants to design a collection of footwear for the ladies."
"Clothes and handbags from Lane Bryant," Sergei said.
We made a pile for the radiologists and osteopaths donating medical care, and one for the dentists offering free cleanings, a pile for hospitals offering beds, families from Bar Harbor to San Diego opening their homes to the girls. By nightfall, we added up money and checks totaling over $6,000, more than enough money to support a trip for the girls. In the next Saturday review, Norman called America electrifying in its generosity. And I was numb with happiness. Our rabbits were coming to America. Chapter 39. Caroline, 1958. Dr. Hitzig and I arrived in Poland that spring. It was a pleasure to travel with the doctor, for he was blessed with a razor-sharp mind and a gentle way one generally finds only in the Amish. He was our American medical expert in orthopedic surgery,
charged with determining which of the Polish ladies were healthy enough to withstand a trip to the United States later that year. I was along to organize the travel documents and smooth the way. An official delegation met us and whisked us to the Warsaw Orthopedic Clinic by private car. Once we entered the clinic, Polish doctors surrounded Dr. Hitzig. They pumped his hand, patted him on the back, and escorted him to a conference table in front of a makeshift stage. I took a seat next to Dr. Hitzig as 29 other doctors, Polish and Russian, followed. There were also two members of Zbovid there, the Society of Fighters for Freedom and Democracy, an official Polish Veterans Association, the authority Norman and I worked with to ensure the rabbit's rights. The clinic was much like the Bethlehem Grange Hall, wide open and so drafty we felt the breeze from the windows even in the center of the room. The first three ladies entered the clinic huddled together, clutching their coat collars to their chins. Each wore a cloth purse over one forearm, and the strain of the trip on her face, for simple steps, appeared to still be painful for all three. Our translator, a severe young man with a Stalin-like head of hair, took a seat next to Dr. Hitzig, and the women walked to the changing screen behind the stage. The first rabbit, a pretty woman in her mid-30s with short dark hair and dark eyes, emerged wrapped like a Greek goddess in a dull white sheet. She shuffled to the folding chair on the stage, wincing with each step. Once seated, she looked over the audience, her chin high. The lead doctor, Professor Grutza, an energetic avuncular man shaped like a fire hydrant, took the stage and read from the document. At seemingly endless intervals, the translator shared the English translation.
The death of Adolf Hitler's close friend, SS Obergruppenführer Reinhard Heydrich, precipitated the ersatz medical experiments referred to as the sulfonamide operations at the Ravensbrück concentration camp. Dr. Karl Gebhardt, close friend of and personal physician to Heinrich Himmler, was called to treat Heydrich, who'd been critically wounded in an attempted assassination, a car bombing arranged by the Czech underground.
I kept my eye on the woman on stage. She held her head high as she listened.
In treating Heydrich, Dr. Gebhardt refused to use sulfa drugs and chose other treatments instead. Once Heydrich died, Hitler accused Gebhardt of letting his friend die from gas gangrene. As a result, Himmler and Gebhardt planned a way to prove to Hitler the decision not to use sulfa had been correct. A series of experiments, first performed on males at Sachsenhausen and then on female Ravensbrück inmates.
The woman on stage brushed her hair back from her forehead, her hand shaking.
Gebhardt and staff performed surgeries on perfectly healthy women, specially chosen for their sound, sturdy legs to replicate traumatic injuries. They added bacterial cultures to the wounds to produce gas gangrene, then administered sulfa drugs to some. Each sulfa patient that died proved Gebhardt's case. The inmates operated on,
Dr. Grutza indicated the woman in the chair,
included Kasia Bakowski, née Kuzmeritsk, currently employed as a nurse for the state.
The doctor pulled back the sheet to reveal the woman's leg. Next to me, Dr. Hitzig took a sharp intake of breath. Her lower leg was shrunken and horribly disfigured, like a gutted fish.
Mrs. Bakowski was operated on in 1942. She underwent three subsequent surgeries, all group one. Bacteria, wood, glass, and additional materials were introduced. An incision was made in the left lower extremity and blood vessels on both sides of the wound tied off.
As the doctor continued, Kasia kept her chin high, but her mouth softened. Her eyes grew glassy.
Ground silica and wood fragments were introduced, and the wound was stitched up and given plaster dressing, said the doctor.
Could the doctor not see she was distressed? I stood and walked toward the stage.
This cast remained in place long enough for gas gangrene and other conditions to develop, the doctor continued. Then sulfonamides were introduced.
The doctors scribbled down notes.
In addition to severe deformity, which affects the entire skeletal system, patient suffers post-traumatic reactions of the brain, depression.
I am sorry, but, Kasia said. She stood, one hand over her eyes, the other holding the sheet to her chest. I stepped up onto the stage. This cannot continue, doctor.
But these women have agreed to this, Dr. Grutza said. The doctors have disrupted busy schedules to be here.
So have the rabbits, doctor. You may continue the examinations in private. You, Dr. Hitzig, and I will be present.
This is highly...
I took Kasia by the hand. These women were victims once, but will not be abused again if I'm here.
Let us continue in the smaller examination room, Dr. Hitzig said.
I helped Kasia off the stage and into the dressing area and did my best to help her dress. Thank you, she said. I appreciate your help. You speak English so well, dear.
Not so much.
Certainly better than my Polish. My sister, Zuzanna, isn't here yet, but she is on the list. She's a doctor and has beautiful English. I will look for her, I said. The exams progressed nicely once they moved to the smaller room, attended only by Dr. Hitzig, Dr. Grutza, and myself. Kasia's sister, Zuzanna, was the last patient examined. She asked that Kasia be allowed to sit in, and the doctors agreed.
Zuzanna Kuzmeritsk, Dr. Hitzig read, 43 years old, a member of the control group of sulfonamide operations, injected with staphylococcus and tetanus bacteria, one of the few controls who, given no antibiotics, spontaneously recovered. Currently experiences cross-lateral headaches, occasional dizziness, and gastric upset. Possible gastric ulcer, treated with antacids.
Dr. Hitzig stopped reading.
Go on, doctor, said Zuzanna. It's fine.
Dr. Hitzig removed his glasses.
I don't think it's...
I've seen it, said Zuzanna.
I wrote it, actually. It says I was sterilized at the camp. Doesn't it?
Kasia stood. Oh, no, Zuzanna.
It's fine. I wrote the report. Please, doctor, continue.
Dr. Hitzig slid his glasses back on. Zuzanna sat straight in her chair as Dr. Hitzig began his examination, feeling the glands on both sides of her neck. Is it hard for you, as a doctor, to suddenly become a patient? I asked.
No, Zuzanna said. It's important to see both sides. Makes me a better doctor. That is one of the reasons I'd like to come to America, and to take more advanced medical classes, and learn as much as I can.
Zuzanna spoke such good English. With her lovely, lilting Polish accent, it was a pleasure listening to her. Dr. Hitzig rubbed two fingers on the left side of her neck.
What is it, doctor? Zuzanna asked.
Oh, nothing, Dr. Hitzig said. I think we are done here for now.
As we cleaned up and the Polish women prepared for the trip home, Dr. Hitzig conferred with his fellow doctors, and I shared the gifts I'd brought from the States. Gather round, girls, I said. I held out one of the lovely handbags I'd brought, this one of navy blue leather. The golden clasp caught the light, These have been donated by a wonderful American shop called Lane Bryant. The rabbits stood still as if rooted in place. Such a serious group. Girls, please don't be shy, I said, holding the bag out farther still. They are free. They have been donated. Blue is the big color this year. Still not a move. I picked up a Whitman sampler box, the name on the package painted in cross-stitch. Anyone for chocolates? No one moved toward me. Fig Newtons? They're cookies. Maybe we should take a photograph, Kasha said, motioning toward my Leica. They gathered for the camera, and the photograph arranged itself, like a bouquet of flowers in a vase. What will this trip be like? Asked Kasha. So far, the plan is the rabbits will start in New York City and then fan out to stay in private homes across the country. Then the group will meet up in San Francisco and travel to Los Angeles and then return across the country by bus, visiting Las Vegas, Texas, and ending in Washington, D.C. Kasha translated to the others, who gathered close to hear. I expected at least smiles, but the women remained solemn. They would like to know where the ship leaves from, said Kasha. Oh, no ship, I said. Pan American Airways has donated the airfare. There was much excited discussion in Polish and plenty of smiles after that. Most of us have never been on a plane before, Kasha said. Dr. Hitzig stuck his head in the door, and all eyes turned to him. We have our final list, he said. May I speak to you privately, Miss Faraday? I rushed to join the doctor back in our exam room. They are all cleared to go on the trip, Dr. Hitzig said.
How wonderful.
I breathed a tremendous sigh.
Except one. The doctor.
Susanna? Why, for heaven's sake?
Sorry to say, I found a hardened varicose node, he said.
What?
It indicates a cancerous tumor.
Can it be treated?
Probably not. It is a strong indication of stomach cancer. Her days are numbered, I'm afraid.
I hurried to the women waiting at the door with their coats on, ready to head home. I asked Zuzana and her sister, Kasha, to meet with Dr. Hitzig and me privately, and ushered them to the exam room. They sat on folding chairs.
Zuzana, I'm afraid... Well, Dr. Hitzig said, the lump I found in your neck is a hardened varicose node.
The seat of the devil, said Zuzana.
I prefer the name signal node, Dr. Hitzig said.
It is a symptom of gastric cancer, isn't it?
Zuzana said.
I am afraid so. Yes.
Too bad to have one named after a German doctor, said Zuzana with a wan smile, eyes bright.
How can you be sure? Kasha asked.
We should do more tests, Dr. Hitzig said. But it is the conclusion of the medical group that you are not a candidate for travel to the United States.
Kasha stood.
What? The whole reason for the trip is to get medical attention not available here. How can you bring us all this way and refuse the person who needs you most? She can have my place.
It is not a matter of space, Kasha, I said.
You talk about helping us, Miss Faraday, but you don't really care. You bring us fancy handbags and expect us to snatch them up. I thought you would like. We are ladies, Miss Faraday. Ladies who don't all like being called rabbits, easily frightened caged animals. Ladies who live in a country where we cannot accept gifts. Is this not obvious to you? a new handbag from an American. People disappear for a lot less. A Polish journalist accepted chocolates from an American, and no one has heard from her since.